This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers, and we're going to talk about one-to-one deployment today, and we're going to talk a little bit more about iCloud. How are you doing, Bradley?
It's been a big week. We start school tomorrow, and really the 2 weeks leading up to school, for me, I don't know about other educational technology administrators, are really your busiest two times of the year. You've got a lot of things, like our fiscal year does not start until August, and then we start school in the middle of August, so there's a lot of purchasing I cannot do until it gets very close to August when the credit card statement has flipped over, mm-hmm. Just because I don't have any, usually at that time, any money left to pay until I get my new, allotment for the fiscal year. So it's just a busy 2 weeks. You've got a lot of people pulling you in a lot of directions, but it's exciting and fun, and kids will be back in the morning. And that's ultimately why we do what we do, and really why we have jobs, is because there are teachers that need support and there are students that need support. So it's been a good week, though. Yep.
Yeah, definitely one of the busy times of the year. My other busy time is the last week of school, when trying to get my iPads back in from the kids and trying to convince them not to lose their cables and chargers over the summer and so on. We're still 2 weeks away from opening school. So last week and part of this week, I've been working on just reconfiguring our iPads. But that's mostly done now. So what we're doing, or what I've been spending my time on for the past couple of days, is working on my teaching. And one of the big projects at Cedars this year is for all of our secondary teachers to adopt iTunes U en masse for teaching. We'll definitely talk about that in a lot of detail in another show. But what I've been doing the past couple of days is just setting up courses and putting together plans and so on. So I'm teaching basically two main courses this year. One is an exam grade course in computing, which is the second year of a two-year course. And that is mostly going to be a straightforward Ruby programming year. And the second course is a new one that I'm just developing right now, which is called the History of Computing, which is not something that is strictly called out in our curriculum, but it's something that I think we don't always teach properly, because we often teach computing as it is right now, and that's enough to overwhelm anybody. Or we maybe talk a little bit about what might happen in the very near future. But we never really go back and talk about people like Alan Turing and Claude Shannon and people like that, and explain to kids, you know, who are maybe 11, 12, 13 this year, how did we get from, you know, having nothing in 1920 to having all of this stuff today? So that was my job today, was just to design a curriculum that goes over about 32 weeks, where each week we're going to talk about some new development in computer science. And not just computer science, but also computing as a discipline and an industry and as a social phenomenon as well. So I'm looking forward to building that course. I think it's going to be really interesting.
Well, I read your notes that you posted earlier today on Twitter, and it looks like a fantastic class, because I've thought about that before, and that although a lot of our students may or may not care about why there are four major browsers today, or five if you count Opera, I think that's history. And with technology being such a big part of our life going forward, that's something that we should know, just because when we talk about, you've seen articles recently about the iPad has such a monopoly, and will it possibly be the target of an antitrust investigation one day? Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of kids, they don't know what that means, but in mine and your head,
why it's such a threat.
Exactly. Because yeah. We all know, well, that basically, you know, almost killed Microsoft's ability to innovate for many years. And they were really limited by that. And so, I think I've thought about that. And when I read your notes, I immediately saved them to Instapaper. I've switched back to Instapaper. It's a topic for another day, but mm-hmm. Immediately saved them to Instapaper, and I just cannot wait to read it. I think if you publish that as a public iTunes U course, it would be something I think everybody under the age of 18 should take.
I certainly hope so. My plan, as with all of our plans for iTunes U adoption, is that this year we're going to do it internally, and then well, basically because I don't have time to write a whole course between now and the end of August. But I'll be building the first sort of 7 or 8 weeks worth, hopefully before our opening day. And then as I go through the year, I'll build up bigger chunks of it. And then hopefully by the end of the year, I'll be able to take that in-session course and polish it up and clean it up and turn it into a public course that everybody can have.
Well, I think it's great. I think, again, I don't think kids don't know where we've come and how we ended up with devices in our pockets. And we were all just happy with, you know, I remember when I got my first flat screen monitor, that was, you know, it was $300 and I was thrilled to have it and I saved forever. And yeah. Now a kid has a phone that has as much memory as my computer did in college.
Well, it's fascinating, you know, in almost every respect, the iPhone 4S is more powerful and has more of everything than the original iMac did.
That's true.
You know, more storage, more processing power, more pixels on the screen, faster connection to the internet. It's incredible, you know, and when I taught a little bit of this last year and I said to the kids, look, there's a Mac Pro server in the corner there that has 6 terabytes of disk and all this kind of stuff. By the time you're 21, that's what you're getting for your birthday, but it's going to be in your pocket.
That's true. I mean, it's crazy how that has changed. And I was talking to one of our employees today, and they were switching to a fiber optic connection. Chattanooga is unique in that we have very fast internet. And so for me, 30 megs up and down is standard for my house. That's the lowest that my internet provider offers. And so one of my coworkers was switching from a cable provider that he had 5 megs. And I made the joke that that's basically dial up to me. And yeah. He said, well, you don't remember. He's a few years older than me. He said, you don't remember true dial up. I said, no, I remember dial up. I remember AOL when it was a cost per hour. But it's just, to me, anything lower than 20 megs, it just feels so slow. And that, again, that just shows you, and even in the past 10 years, how far technology has come.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. One of my interests is always to look at what do we assume is possible now. And we assume that you can just stream a video at any time, basically anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just in your home, but also, you know, you can stream it to your phone. And we've just had the Olympics here in the UK, obviously, and the BBC did a great job of covering the Olympics. But also, one of the things I was very interested in was that they made it so easy to get access to incredibly high quality video of all of these events from phones as well. So there was a special iOS app that came out for it, and you could just stream the highlights of any event that you were particularly interested in right to your phone. And it's like, you know, that's an incredible thing.
Even 5 years ago, really pre-iPhone, you just didn't have that. You had a Motorola Q that you were just happy to get email on, let alone any sort of streaming video of any sort of quality.
And if you could get it, it was a postage stamp.
That's true.
Remember postage stamps? Kids don't know what that is.
No, they don't. We've been off paper report cards for a couple of years now, and mm-hmm. it is wonderful. Report cards now are 2 clicks. We have to load mm-hmm. the classes that are number grades, then we have to load the classes that are letter grades, and then parents can view them in our student information system. And we really make a point to send very little mail home. Most of the mail we send home is actually grandparent related, inviting them to special events. But just, we try to do as much mail as email as possible. Just from a fiscal standpoint, I would rather spend $500 on the volume purchase program than $500 in postage stamps.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when you get up to big numbers in schools, that, you know, the cost of seemingly trivially cheap things start to mount up incredibly.
It's true. So you mentioned, what do you have scheduled for today to talk about?
Okay, so 2 topics we talked about for today. The first one is, how would your one-to-one deployment look today with additional tools that now exist? Which is an interesting topic, given that, you know, we're only really 2 years into the iPad era, 5-odd years into the iPhone era, and the way that you would deploy a one-to-one system today is very, very different to the way you would have done it 2 years ago when I started. So we're going to talk about that. And then the second thing, which is more in your wheelhouse, is why iCloud doesn't necessarily work so well for education, and the comparison there between Google Apps and Office 365.
Well, you know, it's interesting that the tools that, again, in 2.5 years that Apple has released to manage iPads have drastically changed even my workflow and even in cart type scenarios. I don't even know how you began to roll iPads out with iOS 3. Don't even know how you did it.
Yeah. Well, a lot of string and chewing gum and baling wire. But I mean, maybe it would be useful to just kind of go back and explain how I did it back then, and to give people an idea of how times have changed, I suppose. The way this is, you know, if you cast your mind back to August 2010, which is when we were getting started with iPad, all we had was a fairly basic version of iPhone configuration utility at the time and iTunes. That was it. That was all there was. And it was certainly possible to deploy sets of settings. I mean, compared to what's available on some other platforms, you know, iPhone configuration utility is still quite a powerful tool to deploy settings with one click. But that didn't really help you to deploy applications. You could sort of deploy apps in a kind of way, but sometimes it was only ones that you had made yourself and you could sign yourself and so on. That you could deploy through Apple iPhone configuration utility. So many tools now, and they've all got similar names. I'm getting confused. But what we did was our deployment model looked like this. We had three groups of classrooms in the school. There's four classrooms in the primary department, and then three in the lower secondary and two in the upper secondary. And every one of those classrooms had an iMac. Those iMacs actually came from breaking apart our computing lab because we kind of took a big bet right on day one where we said, if we're going to have iPads in these hands, we don't need a computer lab. And that's another show for another time as well. But that's what we did, is we took all these iMacs and we put them one in every classroom. And that was to be the sort of sync station for these iPads. So the teacher would connect the iPads whenever they were ready to do so. And on those computers, there was a special sync user that the teacher had the password for. They would log in as this user, and there was one shared iTunes library in there. So there's maybe like 10 or 12 kids in the class. We have fairly small classes. And all those kids' iPads would be synced to that one library. And that meant that every kid had the same apps. You know, if you just turned on sync all new applications, that was fine. And what I had in my desk, in my lab, was we had a Mac Mini, which was our special iTunes purchasing computer, if you like, and that computer was authorized for all three accounts. So it was kind of like at the center of the Venn diagram, if you like, and it was in all of these groups, and it actually ran three concurrent macOS 10 user logins, each one with a different iTunes library. So there's three accounts: App Store 1, App Store 2, and App Store 3. And this little Mac Mini was running with iTunes, three simultaneous copies of iTunes running, one as user App Store 1, one as user App Store 2, and one as user App Store 3. And there's three distinct libraries, sets of applications, iTunes accounts, all running there. And then that machine is acting as a home sharing server for all the other machines. So classrooms in primary 1, 2, and 3, 4, and 5, 6, and 7, those four primary classrooms, they're all in the App Store 1 home sharing group, and they're all talking to my Mac Mini. So what happens is, if I want to buy an application, I buy it on my Mac Mini, and then it's automatically discovered by those four other classroom computers. And as you know, with home sharing, you can have them automatically copy new purchases from one library to another. So that's how I did app distribution. You can now sort of do that through automatic download rather than home sharing, which is quite nice. But today, or back then rather, I should say, that was how I did it. So that was the model for deploying new applications. Was I get a request from a teacher, I buy it on my computer in whichever one of the three accounts the kids need the application, and then the classroom computers would acquire the binary of that application over iTunes home sharing. And then when the kids sync their iPads, that app will go out to those iPads. The biggest flaw in that was that iTunes home sharing only copies over new purchases. It doesn't copy over updates. So I could click update all apps as much as I liked on my Mac. Many of those apps would never get automatically to the other computers. So what I had to do occasionally was just remote desktop into each machine in turn and hit update all the apps so that the kids would then get the updates on the next round of syncing, if you like. So that's pretty much the model that we still run today. I'm amazed that it has lasted this long. I was certain that this was going to fall apart at some point, but it still works. And The other problem that we ran into with that was that it was quite slow to sync. Syncing is not the fastest thing over USB anyway. And particularly when you plug in 7 or 8 iPads into Hub, our iMacs are not that new. They're not that fast. So it tends to take a little bit of time. But, you know, reliability is the key thing, and it certainly has been a very reliable system, even if it's not been particularly flexible or particularly fast. Now, the role of iPhone configuration utility in that is that we used iPCU to create different sets of settings that we put on the iPads before they went out to the kids in the first place. We actually did 2 different generic profiles and 1 user-specific profile. The 2 generic profiles are, 1, all the information that we want to be on the devices. So our Wi-Fi password, subscription to the school's public calendar. Trying to think what else. Age restrictions in the App Store. So we restricted everybody to 12 plus applications. So that was the what we called the core profile. And then there was a passcode profile as well. So for everybody who's 6 years old and upwards, we want them to have a passcode on their device. But for the 5-year-olds, we don't want to enforce that. So everybody gets the core profile, because without that, you can't go on the internet. And then everybody who's 6 years old and up gets a passcode profile. And then what we did, last thing we did, was we created 1 configuration profile per person. And that delivered their email settings to the device. Because obviously, as you know, email is like the most complicated thing to set up, with POP and IMAP and port numbers and all that kind of stuff. So I actually wrote an Apple script that would script iPhone configuration utility. And what I did was I just, using grep, made 3 massive arrays with username, password, and full name. And the script just stepped through these arrays and generated 1 configuration profile per user to spit that out, so that I could then put that onto the iPads. I should actually probably clean that up and post it on the internet, because it may be useful to some other people as well. But that was what we did. A little bit of iPhone configuration utility, and doing most of the work through iTunes U. Sorry, not iTunes U, iTunes. Again, too many things with the same name. So that's the model that we were at. Other big flaw with that is that it's not totally in line with Apple's terms and conditions for the iTunes Store. And I've always been clear on this point, which is that as soon as I get the tools to deploy in line with the terms and conditions, then I will happily do it. It's not a question of money. It's not a question of trying to be cheap. But I once sat down and worked out how long it would take me to deploy 1 copy of each application to each pupil individually by clicking through the App Store. And I figured it was going to take me a week of not eating, not sleeping, never going to the bathroom, and just clicking through iTunes one by one by one by one all the way. And I figured I wasn't going to spend that kind of time. Turns out some people have since tried this, and it turns out that the longer you go through that process of continually buying things over and over again, your IP address and your Apple ID account will eventually be locked for security reasons, and probably your credit card will be stopped as well. So absent the volume purchase program, which I believe you've got a few opinions on yourself, there really is no way, no tractable way, to fully come into compliance with these terms and conditions. As most people know, I'm sure, at least at the time we're recording this, there is no access to the volume purchase program for iOS outside of the US. So we are still waiting on that. Been waiting quite a long time now, but we live in hope.
And just to clarify, if you've never worked with the volume purchase program, it's actually a separate portal outside of iTunes, which you you set up a program manager and program facilitator account. Allows you to go, let's say if you want to buy 100 copies of Pages, you go in there, you have to get some vouchers from the App Store that are basically gift cards to iTunes. You have to have those mailed to you. You redeem those vouchers on the Volume Purchase Program website, and then you can say, I want to buy 100 copies of Pages. And then it'll take that money out of your, I guess, allotment, and you'll download a spreadsheet that contains 100 codes. Now, the great thing about the volume purchase program in the U.S. is developers have the option, if it's more than 20 copies, to market at half price. So Pages is an example. So if you're buying 100 copies, you get those at $4.99, and it's tax-free. Before, like in your situation, you are probably being charged tax, are you not?
I think so.
Yeah. And your school
European rules and rent tax are very complex, but yeah.
We were always having to pay. It was obviously cents on 99 cent transactions, but they are now tax free. And then from there, with those spreadsheets, you can do a lot of things. If you're in a situation where teachers are kind of in control of their own iPads, or students are in control of their own iPads and either syncing them to their own computers or not syncing them at all and just relying on iCloud, you can send them the codes and they can redeem those on their own iTunes accounts. Or if you're using Apple Configurator, which is really the big brother of the iPhone configuration utility, you can actually import those spreadsheets into the program, has a built-in import feature, and then you will have X number of licenses. And as you sync devices to Apple Configurator, it redeems those. But the great thing about Apple Configurator is you can actually unsync the application and get the license back. Of course, my question is always worst case scenario, what happens if the device is broken and you can't unsync it? I've been told that if you just get in contact with your Apple systems engineer, they can kind of help you get around that problem. But that's what the volume purchase program is. And what is funny to me about that is we started getting iOS devices back in, I guess it was late 2009. And we were told that it's really okay to buy one copy at the time and sync it to as many as you have. That's just the way iTunes works, because obviously your account has a limit of X number of computers on the device, but there is technically no limit to the number of iOS devices.
Yes, because iOS devices are not considered computers. You know, they're peripheral devices, if you like.
The only caveat to that is on the automatic downloads, that is limited to 10 devices per account. So you would not be able to, in your current deployment, just turn on automatic downloads on all the devices. Because that would be beautiful if you could just buy it and it just automatically downloads. But it's limited to 10 devices per account. But then they launched the volume purchase program, and it's not enforced technically still, but if you want to be in line, obviously you want to go by the guidelines that Apple sets. It was still very difficult, and then Configurator made that much easier to deal with. But it's really a bad situation for you all, because you want to use iPads and you want to pay developers for the licenses that you're using, but you've just got no way to give them your money.
That's basically the situation that we're in. I just want to mention one other thing about the automatic downloads thing, because there is another regulator again on automatic downloads, which is that once a device becomes associated with a specific Apple ID for automatic downloads, you cannot associate that same device with another Apple ID for 90 days. I don't know if you've run into this yet, but I ran into it because I have a US iTunes account and a UK one. The US one kind of stems from the early days when I was, you know, occasionally buying things from the US store and also redeeming promotional codes that were only working in the US store at the time. But what I did was that on my Mac, I logged out of my UK account, logged into my US account, downloaded something that I'd purchased, switched back to my UK account and tried to download something. I said, oh, I'm really sorry, you have to wait another 89 days before you can switch this device. I was like, oh dear, that's quite a long time to be locked out of my primary App Store account. So I think the idea with that is that it stops, like, you know, you and I sharing credentials for two different stores or two different accounts, and then I can switch mine to your account, install all your stuff, and then you can switch yours to mine and install all my stuff, and then we switch back and we just go on as before. So I can sort of understand that, but 90 days is a little bit draconian. As I've said before, I think the stench of lawyer is all over that.
I could see 7 days or 48 hours or... And I think it's important to note that automatic downloads and home sharing, those were ultimately built for the home and for you with your family and your wife and your husband and your son and daughter sharing applications and sharing music. And we are, because that's all we can do, trying to shoehorn these methods into our workflows because, as you said, if you did it, each iPad on an individual account, that's all you would do. You would need somebody that was their entire job was buying applications.
Yeah. Yeah. Like what does it mean to buy 100 copies of Pages by logging out of one account, logging into another account, clicking, you know, the 4 or 5 step click to buy it, then logging out and logging into another account. And, you know, the amount of time that would take is just incredible. So that's the reason why we are the way we are right now. Is because it stems from a time before some of these technologies were available. I guess the next question is, well, what would I do today if I was going to deploy? And obviously the answer is different depending on whether I'm in the US or not. The apps, I guess, if we look at it this way, that a world with volume purchase accessible and Apple Configurator and so on is the absolute best form of the argument, if you like. The way I would look at doing that today is individual Apple IDs for those who can have it. And that's another thing we'll talk about in a minute, is who can have an Apple ID. Did we talk about that last week? I think we did. The under 13 limit, I think we talked about that a little bit, but we'll dig into that some more. So the way the world looks like today, I think, is you can use Apple Configurator in one of 3 different ways. I don't know if you've come across this presentation from Apple systems engineers or anything, but there are basically 3 ways you can deploy an iPad, right? The 2 that we know about already are a fully institutional model, which is what I've just described, where the school or the organization buys the apps, has control of the Apple ID, and has control of the experience on the device. And the individual user basically has no power to individualize the device. That's what we call the institutional model, and that's what I've done for the past couple of years, and I'm doing it again for one more year. And then at the other end, extreme end of that spectrum, you have the totally individual model. And this is much more of a kind of university model, where the student is given or buys a completely blank iOS device, and the tutor says, here are the 5 apps you need and the 2 electronic books you need to come to my class. Go away and get them and come back. So in that case, the student is completely autonomous and the institution has no control over the device whatsoever, apart from any network policies they may apply to prevent that device going to certain areas of the network. Those are the 2 kind of polar extremes. But with Apple Configurator, you can actually do something that's kind of a halfway house that they call the layered model. And you've sort of alluded to it when you talked about Apple Configurator and how you can deploy applications and bring them back. So what happens with Configurator is when you import those volume purchase codes, they are actually redeemed by Configurator on your behalf. So you tell Configurator what your institutional Apple ID is, and all of those codes are credited to that Apple ID. Then it shows in Configurator when I import, say, Pages, I've got 100 licenses for Pages, and as I plug in iPads and configure those iPads to have Pages installed, Pages will be installed, and the count goes down by 1. What happens then is that that device has, I used to call this a kind of mingled model of deployment, where there's some content from one Apple ID and some content from another, and they sort of coexist. Now, before that whole 90-day regulator thing, you could sort of do this on an individual basis as well, but it's getting harder over time. But with Apple Configurator, this is absolutely a supported deployment model, where you take those paid apps in the volume purchase program, you layer them onto the device, and then you hand it over to the student. What the student sees is they see the Welcome to iPad setup screen on the front, and they can go through and they can personalize the device. They can sign in with their iCloud account. They can turn on their calendars, turn on, you know, Find My iPad, and all that kind of stuff. And then when they swipe the final button that says, you know, go ahead and use your iPad, what they get is the iPad home screen, and then if you swipe right, it turns out the second page is full of apps that the institution has installed as well. So it's a way of deploying some software to the device before setup has been completed. And that's the layered model. The beauty of that as well is that when you come to the end of the year, you bring the iPad back, you can plug it in and say uninstall all of the institutional applications, and your count goes back up by one for every copy you bring back off a device. So that layered model of deployment is really, I think it's a sweet spot for anybody who is old enough, you know, over 13, to have their own iCloud account. Because what it means is that the students then can, they can buy any content they want, if they've got gift cards or their parents may have associated a credit card with their account, more fool them if they have, I may add, but some parents might do that. Student has a lot of autonomy, and it means it's easier for the institution as well, because I only then have to deal with deploying the paid applications that I want to put on. And any free application in the world, I can just stand up in front of a class and say, kids, hit the App Store and download iTunes U, or download iBooks, or download this free thing or that free thing. Any free application I want, teachers have complete autonomy to just go and get those applications. And that's really, really powerful. Whereas with the paid applications, the institution has a role in just putting those on, maybe, and updating them maybe once a term or something.
That, I agree with you that going forward, that's the model, because a neighboring school, they did the approach you did, where they preloaded them with all the devices, but this was pre-iOS 5 and pre-Apple Configurator. So what happened were students were going home and plugging them up to iTunes and restoring the devices. So yeah. Then they came back to school the next day and had none of the institution installed apps. And so it was really kind of a mess. And so that, I think that's because I believe going forward that students will want to put their own apps on there. And I want them to be able to do that. If they want to buy a different spreadsheet application, that's great. You said in a talk, I guess, a couple years ago about pens and pencils, I believe, and that technology is in the future will be more like that, where if a kid brings his own pen, that's great. We just want him to have some sort of pen. And so if a student wants to use Evernote versus the Notes application or instead of Pages, that's great. We will have the apps that we install for you, but you are free to use the iPad outside of that as you see fit.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, in terms of the sort of pedagogy of this, I think there's space for both, right? There's space for the teacher having some configuration that they can depend on, and then there's scope for personalization on top of that. So we're doing some standardization work with things like, you know, iTunes U is your hub for all your homework and so on. But if you want to take notes in Pages, or if you want to take notes in the Notes application, that part doesn't matter to me as much, because that's IT as a tool to support your learning. It's not a piece of actual teaching that we're doing. And I think that there's space for both. But I do think it is important at some level that the teachers know that there's at least a baseline set of applications that everybody has, and they know that Keynote's there, that Pages is there, if nothing else. And if other people want to do it another way, fine, teachers can be flexible on that. So there's a real balance to be struck there, I think.
Apple Configurator also has a pretty neat tool where you can refresh a device. And so if you bring back in a device 6 weeks later, it will, let's say you preset a wallpaper, which is one of the features of Apple Configurator, is it will refresh that. And if they've changed the wallpaper, it will refresh it to what you preset. And those are big for our deployment, because we're in cart deployments where the iPads go from classroom to classroom throughout the day for different activities. The wallpapers invariably get changed. I wish there was a setting where I could lock that down, since they're not used by just one specific student, but there's not. But Configurator does allow you to quote-unquote refresh the devices. Now, one of the things that I have not figured out the best workflow in Apple Configurator is updating applications, because there is no update button in Configurator. And yeah. So my question is, what do I do? And there are one or two things that I can do. One is to update the apps on the device. And with iOS 6, I'm reading one of the features is you no longer need a passcode. So I can just lay out all of our iPads, hit update, and put them down. Or you can update the applications through iTunes, re-add them to Configurator, but then you also have to just choose the ones that have the updates. Otherwise, it takes a long process depending on how many applications you have. I deployed and imaged 36 iPads in under 4 hours using Configurator full of paid applications. And when it works, it is a magical piece of software. And I think going forward, once some of the major bugs are ironed out, it may be the best application Apple has written in terms of simplicity in years. It just really works for what we're wanting to do, and having the supervised and unsupervised models. Should I go through my complaints at this time, or should we save that for another show?
Hold your complaints for a moment. There's something we haven't really called out here as well, which is that the supervision mode is a new thing that is only accessible through Apple Configurator. Supervision mode is basically a way that you can flip an iPad into supervision mode. And what that means is that that iPad can only ever be synced with that copy of Configurator. And this is really important because, as you mentioned before, in deployments like mine, what I'm doing is I'm relying on students not to go home and connect this device to another computer at home. And I'm begging them not to do that, and I'm giving them dire threats of consequence if that happens, and all your data will be lost, and there's a good chance that is exactly what's going to happen. But with supervision mode, you can turn on supervision, and then that device becomes kind of locked to the machine that you configured it with, which is exactly what we want. One of the things about supervision mode is that it is very deliberately not something you can just flick on when somebody connects an iPad to your computer. You have to actually have the authority and the ability to erase the device. Supervision can only be turned on as part of an erase install. So it is very clearly a sort of institutional strategic decision whether or not the devices are to be supervised. It's not something you can just flick on and off at will.
Yeah, it absolutely wipes it. 'Cause I, in my testing, I had a couple different workflows, whether I worked off of a master image, a backup image, or it erases it all. And my concern with that, since it's syncing to that Apple Configurator, is what happens if that machine dies? If I have a Time Machine backup of that machine and move it to another machine, what happens? Can those devices be synced with that computer then? Does it see it as the same copy of the Configurator? And I don't have an answer for that. And thankfully, the machine I'm using has not crashed, but that is a concern of mine.
Yes, I don't know the answer to that either at the moment. All I was advised by Apple systems engineers was keep a good backup of that machine. So I think it is possible in some way, although I've not tried this recovery procedure myself, it is possible to take your Apple Configurator database and move it to another machine.
One thing that I found out this summer, you see a lot of applications that go free for a day or free for a week. And how does that work with a educational deployment? Can you buy that? And how does Configurator know that you bought that when it was free if it goes paid in the future? What I was told from Apple is that as long as you import the application into Configurator while it's free, that it will not ask for volume purchase codes. But if you purchase it, wait a week to import it, and it has gone back to paid, that it's actually pinging iTunes' database to check for price, and it will ask you to import, even though you bought it for free.
Yeah,
it will if it's a paid app at that time.
The time you import it into Configurator?
So that's again why it's again important to keep a good backup of your Configurator database.
Absolutely. I used Configurator a little bit in our redeployment this year. Even though we weren't deploying the applications through volume purchase, we were still deploying applications through USB sync to iTunes. The other thing that Apple Configurator can uniquely do, I think Xcode can maybe do this as well, but I don't like to bring Xcode into this too much, is Configurator can parallelize iOS installs. So if you can connect 8 devices through a hub to Configurator, it can bring them all up to the latest iOS concurrently. iTunes can only do that one at a time. iTunes can sync as many devices as your USB controller can support, but it will only update the firmware on one device at a time. So that was a big time saver for me this year, even though we weren't doing very much with the rest of the Configurator yet.
Yeah, the syncing process, once it gets started, is actually very fast, and it works well. And again, I imaged 36 iPads in a half a day. I had to image them twice because of a small problem, but it I can see the future of this program, and if you're not using it yet in your one-to-one deployments or even any sort of deployment in your schools, go ahead and download it, get familiar with it, because it's going to be a key component, and it possibly can replace a mobile device management system. Instead of having to buy a server-based system or even using Profile Manager within Lion, depending on your deployment setup and how big your school is, it can possibly negate the need for one of those, which is, again, is a time saver and a cost saver.
I think that's very much related to the model of deployment that you're going to do in your school. I think if, like yourselves, you guys are doing a cart-based deployment, and Configurator is absolutely the right tool for that, because you can check out a device to one user, you can check it back in, and the user data is preserved across those check-ins. You can do a very library-style thing, and no MDM server really supports that kind of deployment, which is, you know, it's just in the nature of the beast, really. That's not what they're designed to do. So I think you have to look at these tools. We've got iTunes, we've still got iPhone Configuration Utility, we've got Apple Configurator, we've got various MDM servers, Meraki, Profile Manager, Jamf, and various others. I forget the names of the other ones. But you've got to pick and choose these technologies based on your anticipated style of use. Are the devices individualized? Are they not? Are they shared frequently? Are they shared infrequently? Does ownership change quickly or slowly? All of that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of those questions are crucial to deciding exactly how you proceed with what mix of these technologies. Because you don't have to use them all. And in fact, you shouldn't use them all. You should choose one or two, depending on what it is you're doing.
Do you ever have complaints when you mentioned they hand them in over the summer? When, let's say, you have a student that takes pristine care of their iPad, and they get back one back that is been used heavily, do you ever have complaints that the one they have isn't as nice as the one they gave you?
I'm sure I'm going to get a complaint like that. This is the first year, this summer is the first year where we've mixed up the iPads. Last year, we kept, every student got back the same device they were issued in the first place. So it's possible that I might get some complaints like that. Although frankly, they're all very heavily used, so I don't know that MD would be able to identify, except there's maybe one or two that have a prominent scratch on the screen versus them all just being a bit grubby. So yeah, I'll probably get a couple of complaints on that, I'm sure.
I was thinking that the other day, because I take pristine care of my gear, and if I was given one back that wasn't that, I'm stuff like that bugs me. I'm a little OCD about my gear.
Yeah,
I guess.
No, I can understand that. I haven't seen too many kids who are that careful with them. To be fair to our kids, though, they have we've had very, very few actual problems with anybody's device, and nobody has been neglectful of their device. They're just used so heavily in our school because it's so fundamental to what we do in the school now that these devices are used very, very hard. And one of the things I noticed as I was going through the set this year was that some of the original Apple cases that we put on them are starting to really fall apart. We've lost maybe five or six of those, but they've just come apart across all the seams and so on because they've just been opened and closed so many times, which is a great sign. I mean, that's exactly what you want. You don't want your stuff to look like new 2 years after you bought it.
Is that the black case that came with the first iPad?
Yes.
We probably take a big risk on cases. We buy the cheapest possible case we can get. We purchased 36 new iPads this summer, and my goal was to spend no more than $4 per case. So I found some black rubber silicone cases on Amazon, and it's worked well for us. We had cheap ones on our iPad 1 carts, and we've since sold all of those. But if I start spending $50 to $60 per case, you get to where you're limiting your iPad purchases. And I would rather have, and to a credit to our kids and our faculty, they have taken pristine care of them, and we have had no drops, and they were in fantastic shape when we sold them. And so that's just really a thought when you start looking at deployments, is when you're budgeting, not only do you have to budget for the device and applications, but also what kind of case model you go with. Because if you are doing a one-to-one deployment in a school that has 300 to 400 students, that's a lot of cases, especially if you're buying the smart cover or the smart case. that adds to what you need to budget for.
Yeah, we leased the cases along with the devices when we started this. And I'm really surprised at how well the Apple case held up. I thought it was going to fall apart within weeks. I thought they would all be gone by now. But they've held up remarkably well and been very robust for us. And they have protected the device pretty well. I also believe that the iPad 1 is probably the most robust iPad that we've had so far. I've talked to other schools where their iPad 2s, they've seen more breakages with those and so on. I don't know many schools that have got iPad 3 yet, actually, but you're right, and it's a bit of a trade-off. It's a wee bit like buying AppleCare, which is another conversation, but you know, do you just pocket that money and then pay for the problems out of pocket, mm-hmm. or do you try and defend against the possibility of it happening in the first place? It depends a little bit. You can also do some things with, you know, if you have the opportunity to, you know, carpet your classrooms instead of having a hard floor, that can help too. A lot of our classrooms are carpeted, actually.
Well, we've got about half and half. The upper part of our school, second, third, fourth, and fifth, is carpeted, but our lower levels are not, mainly because when you have younger kids, they do tend to spill things a little bit more, and it's easier to clean up drink spills and paint or things of that nature. We really, really, knock on wood, have not had any drops, and I'm just waiting for that. And we the AppleCare conversation is for another day, but those are all things you must think about. It's not just deciding to buy the iPad. It's what do you do with all those auxiliary purchases, and how do you handle those, and how do you budget for those, and what makes sense for your school may not make sense for mine.
Yeah, again, it's another thing that depends a little bit on the context of use, particularly if you are going one-to-one and the device is going out of school. That's another thing to think about as well. Is it conspicuous? Is it inconspicuous? And so on.
Do you have any sort of knowledge on the volume purchase program launch date?
I know nothing. Well, yes, I do. The last information I was told was October 2011.
That's close.
Yeah.
And the problem is, and I think I said to you on Twitter the other day, if they don't launch it in the summer, then it doesn't count, because if they launch it in September, you can't make use of it until the following summer.
Yeah.
And I don't know. They've got to be thinking about that. And I just don't – I wonder what is the holdup, because it does drastically change your workflow when you have access to the volume purchase program. And – I just wonder what's the holdup. Is it some sort of tax issue, legal issue, or is there a larger technical issue that we're not aware of?
Yeah, I think out of those three things, I suspect technical issues the least compared to tax and legal issues. If you look at what's on the website, you know, WWDC Apple, they put up a banner on their developer page saying, coming soon to... And they named like 10 countries, UK being one, Spain, Italy, France, Germany, New Zealand, somewhere else. Canada was the other one, I guess. And I think if you're trying to bring it to 10 geos at once, then you're talking to 10 tax authorities, well, maybe more in the case of Europe, and several different legal structures and so on. I know from talking to some companies that have deployed iOS in the UK that there's an open question here so far as to, say, I as a company volume purchase 20 copies of something and I give one to every employee in the company, and then they redeem that app in their own personal iTunes account. Does that constitute a benefit in kind for taxation purposes and employment purposes? Should they be declaring that the company gave me £50 worth of iOS applications as a benefit? You know, in a small way, it's kind of like getting a company car, you know, which we certainly do get taxed on in various ways. Should people have to declare volume purchase codes as a benefit in kind? I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a taxation expert. In fact, I'm a taxation dummy. So I don't know what the rule is on that. I don't know if there is a rule. I suspect they're probably still trying to think about it, given that they haven't mostly caught up with the idea that companies can sell things over the internet to other countries yet. That's another rant for another day as well. So the situation is complex. The situation is not fully resolved all over the world. I certainly think there's some scope for refinement as well, both, you know, for those of you who have one volume purchase and those of us who don't. But I think you're right that it's absolutely, it's a strategic thing. It's not a tactical thing. It's like supervision mode. It's like Apple Configurator. It's like MDM servers. It's something that you have to kind of opt into at a certain point in your cycle. You can't just say, well, okay, it's, you know, January the 30th. We're going to switch over to volume purchase today. You can't do that. You've got to have it as part of your deployment strategy over time.
And this shows you the difference between iOS and a Mac deployment, because if we are deploying a new Mac lab, I can go and buy a volume license of Microsoft Office and install that through Apple Remote Desktop. And not worry, and you can do that yourself with, you need no access to any sort of volume purchase program. You just go to whoever your reseller is and say, I need 30 copies of Office, and then you just plug that package file into Remote Desktop, and it installs it, and you're good to go. Now, while software is drastically less expensive on iOS, this is all a result of the iTunes ecosystem and the Apple ID ecosystem. This stems from all of that. And so that's where there's the complexity.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the payback for this complexity, though, is that you don't have to think about license policing anymore. Because, you know, cryptographically, provably, absent jailbreaking, yes, if an app is on an iOS device and is running, then it has somewhere been paid for, more or less. If you're doing an individual Apple ID deployment, if you are using Apple IDs in the way they're supposed to, and obviously it's getting harder and harder to swap Apple IDs, as we've mentioned already, you don't have to, you know, have a license compliance program. You can just say, well, if it's on your iPad, somebody must have paid for that. Right?
That's true. Well, I think the key is volume purchase program for you going forward.
Yeah, I think that's where it's going. And it clearly is where it's going. And I think we're not going to be on it this year, but hopefully by the time that summer 2013 comes around, this will finally have shipped out in the UK, and we'll be able to start looking at that.
Or at least they will have updated the page that says coming October 2011.
Here's hoping.
Well, that's true. I think, again, it's important to remember that each deployment is different, and that's why you want to sit down with your Apple systems engineer and kind of work through your deployment models so you make the right decisions on the front end, because it's a whole lot easier to change things before you give devices to students than 6 months into a deployment. Then students are frustrated, teachers are frustrated, and parents are ultimately frustrated.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I keep saying, you know, the questions are the same, but the answers are different, you know. So what works for my school might not work for your school, but you and I both have to think about this problem of how do you buy and deploy applications.
That's true.
There it is.
Do you want to push the iCloud conversation to the next show? We're about 54 minutes in. You want to hold that, or do you want to talk about that today?
Yeah, we could probably push that one. You said you had some complaints about Configurator. Did you get most of those out your system already? Or
I did, and there was actually, this is the 14th of August, and right before I started the show, or I came on Skype to start the show, I saw an email about an update to Configurator, which brings it to 1.1.1. The only release note was my exact problem. And so I'll run through basically what has happened. And I had a late night phone call with my Apple engineer and vented to him. And it's not his fault, but I just needed somebody to vent to. So again, when you buy applications through the volume purchase program, you get these spreadsheets. Well, so you download the spreadsheet, and oddly enough, it's not in numbers, it's in Excel. I kind of find that ironic, but it's an Excel spreadsheet. And what the workflow is you take the first code and redeem that in iTunes under your institution's Apple ID. Now, your institution's Apple ID is different from your program manager or program facilitator account in the volume purchase program. where the program manager is the kind of your head person and your program facilitator are the people that are actually buying applications. So in your school, you might be the program manager and you may have teachers that are program facilitators.
So you the institutional Apple ID is the Apple ID that you're going to layer on these applications with.
That's right? Correct. That's
because
correct.
Essentially what you're doing with that step is you're getting a copy of the application binary that is signed for that Apple ID.
Because you have to actually get the file.
You have to get one copy somehow.
You have to get
and
the
configurator
file.
Doesn't do that.
And it should. And that's the fact that iTunes is involved at all, again, is a frustration. Again, that may be fixed in the future. We'll see. So you get the application. So you download that. You add that application to Configurator. It'll prompt up the menu that says, "Please import spreadsheet, a volume purchase program spreadsheet." So then you will import a spreadsheet. So in our situation, I bought 36 licenses of an application. You redeem one. So on the spreadsheet, you really only have 35 that are good left. But Apple Configurator is supposed to compensate for that by always giving you plus one. In 1.0, that was not the case. They had to fix that quickly. I don't know if the people writing Configurator did not think about that or if it was just a bug. But they got out a 1.01 quickly that, again, that basically gave you a credit for the one you redeemed inside of iTunes. Well, then an additional update came out fixing some other minor problems, but that there was a regression that caused the original problem of the missing a app license to come back. And so I was imaging iPads and I got down to my last set. I was doing six at a time and I didn't have enough application licenses left. And so I go back and I count and I bring up the menu that shows your codes, and it says this one has already been redeemed. Well, it has in iTunes, but it's supposed to give me credit, and it wasn't. So then you're thinking, what do I do? Because you're missing an app license. So you have to get on the phone with Apple Enterprise Support. They have to remote desktop into your machine, see that that is the case, and then they give you a case number, and you have to email a special email address that goes to the Volume Purchase Program team. Notice I didn't say phone call. You have to email them. And it is a 48-hour response time. And that's if you get the right response on the first time. So I sent them my problem. Hey, I've got these. I think it was 10 applications that had the issue. I've got these 10 applications that I am missing license for in Configurator. Well, they respond back. Well, what are the codes you're missing? Well, there's no way to copy and paste the codes that are already redeemed from Configurator.
So yeah, then you they're all gone into a database somewhere.
And they're grayed out, so you can't select them. And so you then have to manually copy those codes into an email. And if you're getting confused, you should be. It is an absolute terrible situation. Well, then they replied back and said some of these codes are wrong. And obviously, I probably mistyped them. And so then they asked for my spreadsheets. And on top of the spreadsheets, I took screenshots of each application's window and Configurator showing where it said it was already redeemed. Sent that to them, waited an additional 48 hours. So this is all over the span of multiple days. They finally sent me back spreadsheets that I could then re-import to Configurator to increase my license. I still had one that the code gave an error on. It wasn't this application has been redeemed. It was just a generic error. So I emailed them. This was on a Friday. On Monday, I'd still not heard from them. This is a couple days ago. I just went and bought the application again through the Volume Purchase Store. It was a $2 application. I wanted to finish these iPads. So I just bought it and said, I'll just deal with it. Well, then I actually got the updated spreadsheet today. So my complaint to my Apple rep was, it's not acceptable if I'm having licensing issues to have to email a generic group and wait 48 hours for support. I should be able to pick up the phone, call this group, explain my situation, and get codes immediately sent to my email address. Then I can then re-import. Because if I was in crunch time on a big one-to-one deployment of 150 devices, 200 devices, you just don't have the time to wait on an email response and hoping you get the right response on the first email. And so I complained to my Apple rep. I complained to my Apple systems engineer. I complained to my inside sales rep at Apple about these problems. I sent some very sternly worded emails, which I then followed up with an apology because I felt bad about it, because I know it's not their fault. They're not writing the configurator program. And they assured me that they are aware of the issues and a fix is coming soon, and they feel my frustration. And I think it just shows that Configurator was largely half-baked when it came out. It was a 0.5 rather than a 1.0. But again, an update is out today that the only release note is fixing the problems importing spreadsheets. It wasn't an issue with syncing devices. It wasn't an issue with getting the right settings on the device. It's only an issue with your license counts in Configurator. And then my final solution for the one app that was screwed up at the after it was all said and done, was to just rebuy it and just not worry about it. At some point it was $2. At some point it's just easier to rebuy it.
Yeah.
And if you follow me on Twitter, you probably saw a lot of tweets of just sheer frustration on a program that should be so great and should be so easy, just simply not working. But ultimately, my problems are resolved, and I hope going forward that it doesn't occur again.
Yeah, in some ways, you know, back in 2 years ago, we had no expectation that this would be easy. You know, we just knew everything was going to be a pain, and it was going to be a lot of brute force and touching every device and so on. And Configurator kind of holds out the hope of a lot more automation. And when it works, yes, you know, you can dramatically speed up your workflow with that tool. But when it doesn't work, you know, I think your expectations are set in such a way that it's even more frustrating when you bump into something like that.
Well, and especially because Configurator is the only authorized way to work with the volume purchase program by Apple. It's the only supported way.
And it's the only way to be in compliance with the terms and conditions as well.
Which we absolutely want to do. It was mind-boggling that it wasn't working. And from an enterprise level, we are an Aerohive school for wireless, and I love Aerohive. And if I have an issue, I can either pick up the phone and call them, or I can put in a support ticket. When I call them, the first prompt is, if this is a network down emergency, press 1. And I can almost guarantee if I press 1, somebody's picking up the phone. And I kind of expect that same thing from Apple. And if I'm having licensing issues with their application and their volume purchase program, waiting 48 hours for response is really not acceptable.
Yeah.
From an enterprise setup, an enterprise and education setup, it's just not acceptable. And I know this whole program is new, and so my hope is that they do realize that email support is just not going to cut it. And again, if it was a 4-hour response time, I might could deal with it. But as you know, with working with support via email, if you don't explain everything right the first time, or they don't understand it and have to ask for clarification, that really just starts your tickler over again for another 48 hours. And
that's another trip around the cycle.
It was just frustrating, and ultimately I got it fixed, and I'm happy with my deployment this year. I had to buy one extra application license, and I made the joke to my Apple systems engineer, maybe in the future I'll just buy 3 or 4 extra of what I need just in case.
That may not be the worst approach, actually, because that would also give you some coverage in the situation where a device breaks irreparably and you can't bring it back into Configurator and uninstall its application and get its license back. That may be a valid disaster recovery procedure as well.
Especially for the applications that do provide the discount, because the application that I had to rebuy did offer the discount. So I actually only paid 99 cents for it originally per license. But when I bought that extra license, it was $1.99. And so had I just bought 3 or 4 extra at the time, I would have got it at the discount. And it's really strange for a 99 cent application to be only 49 cents per license. Our Coke machine is 65 cents. And then I'm buying an application license for 49 cents.
Yeah, you feel kind of terrible being very nitpicky about how many you're buying and, you know, all this for something that's only that price. But I guess, you know, as we move towards one-to-one deployments, you know, okay, it's only 49 cents per device, but okay, in this big school, I've got 1,100 devices. You know, we're buying, the apps are cheaper, but we're buying, you know, 100 times as many copies as we ever used to, you know.
You're not buying it just for a Mac lab or maybe one to two Mac labs of 15 to 20 in a lab. You're buying it for every single student. Yeah. And again, you just want to be you always want to be in compliance. And mm-hmm. it's just frustrating when you feel like that you're following the rules and it's hindering your workflow. But again, this program was only released on the day of the third iPad announcement. So it's relatively new. And this is really the first summer that any school probably has used it. Since it was released in the spring, no school has deployed until now with it, most likely. And so I'm sure I'm not the only person that's been frustrated. I probably should do a search on Twitter to see. But I went home that day, and when I explained to my wife what I was so frustrated about, I think she was changing my son's messy diaper, and she kind of looked at me like, you think you have problems? You've got app licenses that aren't working, that I have, that I have change in my wallet that can take care of that. It's a small issue, but you just want these deployments to go well, because you can't really fix it once school starts. It's got to be with education. It's really weird, and it's kind of like an airplane. The most dangerous times are school starting and ending. And so, like, you've got an airplane taking off and landing. Once school started, everything generally you hope runs pretty smooth, and you don't want to have to make drastic changes mid-flight. You just want to be able to plan well in June, July, and August and have it go well once school starts, because I view our students and our teachers as my customers, and I want my customers to be happy with me. And if I have to come back in September and say, okay, I blew it, I made a mistake, I've got to redeploy these, and they're going to be out of commission for 7 school days,
yeah,
nobody's very happy with me. And especially in your situation, you would drastically impact instruction.
Absolutely. You know, I would have to make that happen class by class over a weekend. You know, you would have to figure out some way to make that as transparent as you could possibly make it. For our kids who take them home, you know, it's very, very difficult to do any kind of major change without interruption.
I feel like my workflow description there was kind of confusing. And so I just want to, I guess, reiterate, if it sounds confusing, it's because it is with getting the codes fixed. It's a very confusing and very un-Apple-like. And that's one of the things you'll find when you're working with the backside of Apple, whether it's the volume purchase program, or if you're a certified Mac hardware technician and you have access to GSX, which is where the geniuses log in to log repairs and to order parts. You'll see a different side of Apple that's not as polished.
Same thing in iTunes Connect if you're uploading, you know, iOS applications or Mac applications or so on. Those tools are certainly getting better as well, but you're right, there's a lot of very kind of generic enterprise-y systems in the background there. It doesn't all run on iWork.
The one I laugh at is GSX, and they just launched GSX2, which stands for Global Exchange Service. It does not work on the iPad. And I find that hilarious that a brand new system doesn't work on the iPad. You would think that would be designed from the ground up for the iPad, because I'm ultimately using my iPad when I'm taking apart Macs to order parts and look up repair manuals, because on my workbench, I don't want to bring my laptop. I just want to bring my iPad, but it's unusable. And so, again, that's just the different side of Apple, and they put so much focus on what the end user sees. When you see their back-end systems, you do realize that they're just regular people, and they have 404 links and things like that, and servers that go down in the middle of the day. And I get emails every Friday from the service source, which is, again, part of the GSX, and they will take it offline for weekends at a time just to do maintenance. And that's just the stuff you see. Apple is just a regular company with regular people, with servers that need to be patched and bugs that are pretty big.
This is how the sausage is made.
That's true. So we'll save the iCloud discussion for next episode. Give everybody a reason to come back. If you're on Twitter, you can follow me at Bradley Chambers, and my blog is chambersdaily.com. And Fraser, do you want to tell them where they can find you on the rest of the internet?
Well, I'm on app.net. As at FS.
I did not know you were on there. I'm at Bradley Chambers as well. I need to write down your username. See, it's confusing when it seems like a lot of the people I follow have decided to change names on app.net, and I don't know where they are. Dan Benjamin, for example, is just Dan, or Benjamin Brooks is now Ben Brooks. And so I basically find people that I follow and see who they follow.
Yeah, I mean, those guys and I are all in the kind of Twitter long name crew. I think a lot of us have taken the opportunity to shrink it a little bit.
So it's just
all 16 of our listeners who are on app.net can get me there.
So it's at FS.
FS on app.net.
Okay.
on Google Plus, I am AF70. sorry, that was not fair. Twitter, Fraser Spears, FraserSpeirs. And spears.org is my blog.
We thank everybody for listening. If you have comments or questions about any of the workflows or anything you'd like to see in the future, or corrections if we really blew it on a topic, there is a contact form on the website outofschool.net that you can contact us. And we appreciate you listening, and we will see you next week.